I did, so I just kept wanting to reiterate one idea that was figured prominently in yesterday's lecture, which is has to do with the fact that you can take wave vectors, all possible wave vectors of free particles, and classify them by a reciprocal lattice vector and a wave vector in the first Brillouin zone. It's a little bit like saying that you can take all numbers and classify them by their integer part and their fractional part. Okay, the point is that the states or the wave functions that have the same value of the wave vector in the Brillouin zone but correspond to different reciprocal lattice vectors, those wave functions are mixed by the periodic potential of the lattice. Okay, and then we discuss the fact that the way they're mixed depends on how close they are to each other in energy. The different states with the same wave vector in the Brillouin zone, if they're far apart in energy, then they're not perturbed very much. But if they happen to be, as they are at the zone boundaries of the Brillouin zone, they tend to be degenerate states. And those are strongly mixed by the periodic potential of the lattice, which opens up gaps, forbidden regions in energy. And so all along the face of the Brillouin zone, you have these energy gaps. And that divides your energies up into what we call bands. And the bands are what the sort of the one electron picture of electrons in metals and insulators. Okay, so that was just saying in words. Also, the other point that I wanted to make is that my notes, Dennis is posting my notes. In fact, I'm trying to get to the point where he'll be able to post them before the actual lecture. And the notes, I'm trying to make them actually neat and clear. And so I might gloss over things in the lecture, but you can always find them in the notes. If you want, you can just bring them up and follow along in the lecture if you want. Okay, so I wanted to start today by talking about tight binding bands again in a little bit more detail and with a few more equations. And I think I explained that, you know, the philosophy of the tight binding picture, it's the opposite limit from nearly free electrons. It's based on the idea that if you build a solid from atoms by bringing them together, when they're far apart, the electronic states are localized on atoms. And as you bring them together into the solid, they start to overlap. And so you can describe your basic orbitals as residing on atoms, one atom or the other. And you can write down a Hamiltonian, which is the tight binding Hamiltonian. Part of what I'm doing now is, once again, for notation. Particularly this part. This is a little delta. So this is your tight binding Hamiltonian. It basically says, for a single orbital per site, it basically says that in a first approximation, an electron in that orbital has an energy E naught, and that because of the hybridization of the orbitals between nearest neighboring sites, there's this hopping probability where you can go from site I to site I plus delta. What do I mean by delta? Delta, this is just sort of standard notation. So delta labels and of course what that means will vary depending on what the crystal structure is, what the nearest neighbors are of the site, or what the neighbors are. You can imagine having nearest neighbor vectors and second neighbor vectors and overlaps, making this more complicated. So what I means here, some lattice site whose position is Ri, and this is summed over lattice sites, and what I plus delta means in this little label here is the atom plus the vector delta, which connects site I to its neighbor at I plus delta. So, for example, if you have a square lattice, then your deltas would be plus or minus x and plus or minus y for unit lattice constant. Okay, and the sum over delta means summing over those four positions. So then you can see sum over I and delta of C dagger I plus delta C I. So this is summing over the whole lattice, and at the same time summing over the four the neighbors of every site that you sum I over, that if you do that, then so here's RI plus X, RI minus X, and so forth. But you can see that because you're summing over every site in the crystal, that this includes the terms that hop you. So this thing here takes you from site I to one of these. But there's another term where I is over here, which hops you from here to here. And so this includes all the hopping both ways on all of the bonds. OK, so that's just a, this isn't just a one-way hopping Hamiltonian. It takes you back and forth between all possible nearest neighbors. OK, now what did I want to say about T, this hopping integral? Actually, Dennis has a problem. Is that today? The Kronig penny, yeah, right. Okay, so Dennis has a little. You're going to calculate the band structure for a moderately artificial solid, the one-dimensional Kronig penny model, and you will then be able to see how it evolves continuously from the free electrons through nearly free electrons to this tight binding thing, and when you make the barriers high enough or whatever, or thick enough, or whatever, you can see how you eventually get to just this and this when the states are well localized with small overlaps. Okay, so I hadn't given anything away there, right? No. Okay, so the other thing that I wanted to say is that this type of picture, which is indicated by this the simplest of cases, quite naturally would also come up in molecular physics. Of course, I mean, solids are just very big molecules, right? And so if you were trying to calculate the electronic states of a small molecule, you could have the same type of picture where the electrons were delocalized across atoms in the molecule. And Slater has tabulated overlap integrals for different kinds of orbitals. So these would be atomic orbitals of the type NL for different elements, where N is a principal quantum number, and L is the angular momentum of a particular orbital, the magnitude of its angular momentum. So this would be, you know, like S, P, D, F, so forth. And you can use these same overlap integrals that are in Slater's book and papers. I think the last time I looked at this, it was in some old, one of Journal of Chemistry. I forget what their most standard chemistry journal is, but it's the like Physical Review. But and you can find all these things tabulated. There's lots of interesting little bits of physics in the, you know, how the overlaps work for particularly the higher angular momentum orbitals, things like that. Okay, so the point is that you can apply this type of theory to solids and molecules too. So let's just go through some of the algebra. So you can diagonalize this. So this is obviously not diagonal because you can hop from, there are matrix elements involving every site. You can diagonalize this Hamiltonian by Fourier transform. I don't know if we've done this. I guess we haven't exactly done this before. Where K now is in the Brillouin zone, is a vector in the Brillouin zone, first Brillouin zone. So if you put this in to that, you get that one I want here. That's from the first term, minus T. Okay. And this thing here, okay, so sorry, if we can do this sum over all lattice sites now. This is equal to the number of sites if k and k prime are equal. and otherwise. It's zero. Okay? Because this difference of two points in the Brillouin zone is never a reciprocal lattice vector. Except maybe if they're right on the edge. But you don't include both edges. So. Okay, is that obvious to everybody? No. K is a vector in the Brillouin zone, so K is equal to, what do I want? 2 pi over a lattice constant times L over L M over L N over L for an L by L by L, or in our case, I guess we might probably be working with two dimensions, but it doesn't matter, for L to the D crystal. And these guys are integers that go from probably minus L over, roughly minus big L over 2 to plus big L over 2. Yeah, Joe.
In the last one, where are the derivatives?
Say that again?
The derivatives there, but
I'm sorry. I'm missing some brackets, yeah. Probably there's a bracket. Here, right? Because everything carries along one of these factors. And this comes out. Yeah. OK? Yeah, because and the enon and the t get included. Right. So it's the two terms. This is the first term with that taken out. And this is the second term. Okay, so obviously the sum over I of this here gives you k equals k prime. Actually, the sum over I of this, this has exactly the same factor, edik dot ri minus ik prime dot ri. But this also has an additional factor that doesn't depend on the lattice site, which is ik dot delta. Okay? So you can do this sum for both terms, but you're still left with a factor minus, in the second term, of minus t sum over delta e to the I k dot delta. Yeah?
Do you need to include the boundary of the solid for that top line to be true? On the right hand forward, that line there, you said you weren't including the
in k space. This is an equation that's true for every pair of k, k prime that are in the Brillouin zone. Okay. As far as the boundary of the crystal goes, you may recall we have no boundaries because we're taking everything to be periodic. Life's simple. Okay. So there's this factor here, which enters in the second term, which clearly reflects the structure of the crystal, because it just depends on what the nearest neighbor vectors are for every site. So just to give you the simplest example, for the square lattice, this is equal to minus 2t cos kx plus cos ky. And that's because delta is x minus x, y minus y. And the 2 comes from the cos being half the sum of the exponentials. Or no, actually, cos is. 2 cos is the sum of 2 exponentials. So what's the answer then? The answer is that H in its diagonalized form. Where this epsilon here of k for the square is equal to E naught minus 2t cos kx plus cos ky. Bruno.
Why is it that like by the conventional to write minus t?
Minus t, yes. Okay, good question. Okay, why is it? Okay, so the point is that if t is very small, or zero, then you have minus, you have some energy. Okay, so the question is that when you bring them together, do you
want it to lower again?
Do you want to lower the energy if you fill the lowest states? Okay, and the point is that that you need that plus the fact that the lowest energy states will be the ones that are most, where the wave function is uniform. Okay, so if you look at this formula here, k equals zero would be a uniform superposition. It would just say that the wave function is equally distributed on all sites. If you think that that should be the lowest energy state, then you put a minus sign. But it's all coming from kinetic energy. That the fact that if they don't hop, they have a higher energy than if they do hop. Okay, so that's the minus sign. Yeah?
But how is it tightly bound?
It's tightly bound because T is small. Okay? Yeah. What would happen?
So T is sort of the perturbation to the tight binding.
In other words, you're starting from the atomic limit, where you have isolated atoms, and then you're allowing them to overlap a little bit. That's the idea. I mean, if you had, how would you go from this limit to the opposite limit? I mean, to go from this limit to the opposite limit, you would really squash the atoms together so that the electrons were just, you know, each electron was seeing a lot of ion cores or something like that, and that they were almost freely moving. So then you'd be more like this picture where there's a large kinetic energy because they're free to move around, and the ionic potential is some relatively low amplitude ripply type thing. Okay, you just imagine squashing them together very closely. Then this picture wouldn't work. And you'd also probably mix up lots of different orbitals. So it would be more like a bunch of electrons in a box with ions distributed in the box, too. Yeah?
If you have tight binding on a lattice,
yeah,
would it be the opposite limit
on
the reciprocal lattice?
No. Reciprocal lattice is just another way of is another way of writing.
So
it's another tight binding versus nearly free electron? No, it's not. You can see.
Well, see if you had something that was well localized in position, which would be something like tight binding.
Yeah.
It would not be well localized in momentum. So going to the reciprocal lattice is not like.
Yeah, so our basis functions here are localized. When we started out in nearly free electron theory, we started out with basis functions which were plane waves.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So that's certainly true. But on the other hand, because you're in a periodic potential, when you want to diagonalize your Hamiltonian, you still want to work in the representation labeled by the lattice momentum. Because even though these guys are relatively isolated, they nevertheless know that they're part of a periodic lattice. So the eigenstates are labeled by crystal momentum, just as the nearly free electron states are labeled by crystal momentum. Okay. It's just that nearly free electrons, you start out with a complete basis because you're starting out with the plane waves that can represent anything. Okay, and you turn on the crystal potential and you just break up into many bands. Okay? Whereas here, we're starting out with a much smaller basis of just one orbital per atom, and we get one band. Now, mind you, I'm supposed to be saying this over and over again. Let's see if it's the next thing I was going to say. No, it isn't. This is a simplified picture of one-band model. We could have started out with looking at several different orbitals, highest occupied orbitals on each atom, and had a more complicated tight binding band structure where this thing would have been a matrix, and these things would be labeled by not only by a site index, but an orbital index. And then you could generate a much more complicated band structure.
Tibber. So there isn't a band gap here.
No, exactly right. There's just one band. That's exactly right.
Well, there is a band gap.
There would be. There would be, yeah. Yeah. For in this picture, it's just one band. But if you started putting in multiple orbitals, then you would find, because of the they're organized in a crystal lattice. So, to the extent that there would be, either to start with, they would be orbitals at rather different energies, in which case you would say there was a gap between them. Or if they had a tendency to, if there was some overlap in the spectra, then they would have gaps at the appropriate places. You'd get a complicated band structure. Okay. I just wanted to say a couple more things about this. Actually, what's this for the cubic lattice? What is this formula? Instead of square, you go to cube? Yep. Kz, you're right, yeah. So it's cos kx plus cos ky plus cos kz. But it's still 2 because it's the one in the plus direction and the one in the minus direction. Okay, so it's cos kx plus cos ky. But this thing here goes from minus 4t to plus 4t, and the cubic one would go from minus 6t to plus 6t as the cosines go from. There might be some caveat there, but let's. Okay, so what does this thing look like now? It's useful to notice that for small k, you can expand the cosines, and so this is equal to. What do I want to say? Minus 2t times 1 minus kx squared over 2 plus 1 minus ky squared over 2. And that's equal to e naught minus 4t plus t, 1t, times kx squared plus ky squared. So in other words, near the bottom of this band, when k is small, your energy goes like k squared, just like for a free particle. Okay? Because the bottom of this cosine-like band is a parabola, it's a two-dimensional parabola. And this T here is, you can think of this T as h bar squared over 2 m star. So narrow bands, small hopping corresponds to large effective mass. So that's one way of getting heavy electrons. It's the least interesting way of getting heavy electrons. So to conclude tight binding, let me just draw some contours of constant energy in K space. So if this is kx, and this is ky, and this is pi minus pi, pi and minus pi, so in kx, ky space, a surface of constant energy small constant energy, low constant energy, because of this k squared type behavior, would look like this. Let's call this a surface of constant energy E1, where E1 is greater, but not too much greater, than E0 minus 4t. So that's the surface of constant energy in K space of states that are near the bottom of the band. Now, why are we interested in surfaces of constant energy? Anyone want to speculate on that? I mean, how do you construct the ground state when you throw the electrons into this band structure? Yes, yes. No. Okay. Fermions, yeah, Tibra.
The effective mass or?
No, no. It's okay. So yeah, Joe.
Are you saying that if you draw all the surfaces of constant energy, then if you were to just start throwing electrons in, they fill up from the lowest energy state?
Yeah. So the ones, however many you put in, will fill up the lowest energy states, and the highest occupied state will be a surface of constant energy in case of it, because obviously these guys are all degenerate, so you'll fill up to some level. So if the chemical potential lies close to the bottom of the band, then your Fermi surface will be this little circle. Okay? It won't exactly be a circle because it'll be distorted by the higher order terms in the cosine, so it'll have a square-like appearance. Okay? But that would be your Fermi surface for a chemical potential that lies close but just above the bottom of the band, which means that there aren't very many electrons in that band. Okay? So that's one possible Fermi surface for this band structure that corresponds to low density. What about half fill? So say, okay, so then the condensed matter guys would say, okay, well, what is the Fermi surface for the half filled band? Some of you condensed matter aficionados probably know. Yeah, Felix.
It's a straight line.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So, and in fact, it's obvious then. Once you see it. Because remember, there's one state per unit area in K space. So half filled means that you fill half of the Brillouin zone. Okay? And actually, it's interesting because if you have a number of electrons that are equal to the number of lattice sites, taking into account the fact that they have spin, so they can be either up or down, then they would fill up half the states in the Brillouin zone. There's actually two n states in the Brillouin zone because of spin. Is that a question?
Yeah. You could fill half the area of the Brillouin zone with a circle. I don't understand why it has to be straight
lines. Oh, yeah. And it doesn't, right? But if the energy momentum relation were k squared everywhere, then you would fill up half, you'd fill up a circle. Okay, but the energy momentum relation isn't k squared. It's cos kx plus cos ky. And I leave it to you to convince yourself that a constant energy line for cos kx plus cos ky are these diagonal lines. fantastic. I have exactly the colors that I have in my notebook. Okay, and so then the other situation is what happens if you draw a constant energy surface near the top of the band? What's that going to look like? So what's your Fermi surface going to look like if your energy is close to, but not quite? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, just.
T over the square root of 2, or 2t times
pi over 4. This is pi. That's 0. Pi 0.
Oh.
This is pi 0. So you have cos pi plus cos 0. And here you have cos 0 plus cos pi.
Right.
And here you get everything in between. So so what do you want? Pi over 2, pi over 2, that's 0.
Pi over 2.
And so forth. Pi. So there's no. Yeah. It's pi over 2, that's the point, yeah. Yeah, this goes from minus pi. Remember before we had it goes from q over 2 to minus q over 2? The q has a 2 pi in it.
Yeah.
So it's pi minus pi pi. Okay, so here E2 equals E naught, and then we want to do E3 is less than but approximately equal to E naught plus 4t. And what does that look like? Little things, yeah, in the corners. Right, exactly. So it looks exactly like this, except if you draw it in the first Brouwer zone, you get little quarter circles around the corners. And so there's two different ways of looking at these things. You can just sort of translate your origin and say, oh, this is a circle. Or you can say that, what do we want to say? This from here. You can translate this by a reciprocal lattice vector and put it over here and so forth. I mean, you can repeat this whole Brouwer zone if you want to see how things connect together, which one does want to do in interpreting certain experiments, like de Haas van Alphen measurements and things like that, where you want to see where the closed sections of Fermi surface are. So you can repeat this whole scheme and make a very nice pattern. But what's up? Oh, did you? Oh, with the cosine. Yeah, right. Okay, good. Yeah. Okay. So, and it's right, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, good. Okay, so that's it for tight binding. I mean, for non-interacting electrons. Actually, I guess everything that we do now, from now on, has to do with interacting electrons. So. Okay, so with some trepidation, the next subject is Hartree-Fock for fermions. Actually, what I should call this, I suppose, is Hartree-Fock for electrons in a crystal. Okay, and there's some references that I used when I made these notes up. One of them is Wen's book. So which is QF quantum field theory of many body systems. And And it's actually section 5.2 in that book. And the other one is this nice book by Bruce and Flensburg. B-E-R-G. And there it's section 4.3. And both of those books are on the shelf. And I probably followed Bruce more than Wen, although I looked at both of them. So what's the problem here? So we've talked about free electrons and how they, the rules that govern them, how they fill up their states. We talked about electronic states in a periodic potential of a crystal lattice, so electrons interacting with a lattice. And now the last ingredient is electrons interacting with each other. And that is by far the least trivial and most interesting problem. And Hartree-Fock theory is an approximate way of describing what happens. So what is the interaction? Well, there's many ways of writing, there's many possible ways of thinking of the interactions between electrons. So let's adopt a particularly simple possibility, which is that our electrons are in wave functions that are approximately localized, but nevertheless overlapping. So in other words, the tight binding picture. And electrons on different sites interact with each other through some potential. So that's the tight binding picture of the system. Then the interaction is going to be something like this. So again, alpha and beta are spin indices. I and j are the positions in which the orbitals are centered. V of ri minus rj is some potential, some function, which depends on the separation between the two sites. And these guys are the old fermionic Abbe anti-commutation relations and have spin. Okay. Any questions about that? So the important thing is, as I said, that these guys, this creates an electron in the orbital on site I with spin alpha. And there's different ways of writing this product of four operators. I've just picked one that's relatively convenient. So what do I want to say? A more general, as I keep saying for a tight binding, a more general model would have more than one orbital on each site. So for instance, if you had, so that would require an additional index here to say which orbital on that site. And then this interaction could be between electrons on different sites in either the same orbital or different orbitals on those two sites. Or also it could include interactions between electrons on the one atom, but in different orbitals. Okay, or even, I guess, with the same spin in different orbitals. You can get very complicated interactions for systems that are the ones that we're normally interested in, like, say, systems with d electrons. But we won't do that. We'll just do one orbital per site. Yep. It's anti-commutative. So if they have different indices, then they just anti-commute. If they have the same index, then their anti-commutator is 1.
So you can have, like...
I could have written this differently. Yeah, I could have moved this guy over here, say. So then that would be like the density of particles on say I, this would be the density of particles.
Have Bose on one side.
If I had had what?
Bose.
Both.
Yeah,
you could have on one side. Have I said that I is not equal to J?
Oh.
I don't think I've said that. But what I will say is that this potential is the interaction between electrons in two different orbitals, say, for instance, on two different sites. It's not. So this already incorporates into it the fact that an electron in one orbital is in that orbital, is distributed in that orbital, and the electron on the other orbital is distributed in another orbital. So it's like a form factor, always a confusing word, it's like a form factor which goes in here, which depends on the actual shape of each of those orbitals. Okay? So that's all built into the V. So it's not like the Coulomb interaction. It may, it of course results, arises from the Coulomb interaction, but it also arises from the fact that each orbital is the solution to the Schrodinger equation for that atom in the first approximation. Okay. So that's the interaction, and we add it back into the Hamiltonian this way, that our Hamiltonian then is sum over k and alpha epsilon of k. We put in the chemical potential. That's our unperturbed part of the Hamiltonian plus so this is our tight binding band structure, which comes from solving the non-interacting problem. So now we're going to do the same transformation to waves, we're going to Fourier transform these localized operators using that expression, which I've already written down, so I won't write it down again. Of course, we've got four of these guys. Oh, sorry, yeah. Okay, I guess I've gone over to capital R's for this problem. So that's putting in that expression for C dagger I in terms of its Fourier components. And so now we do what we probably should have done quite a while ago. This chalk is not that great. Sorry. Which means that Rj is equal to Ri minus rho. So we're going to substitute for Rj, write it in terms of Ir plus the difference. Where does that get us? That's actually all we need. No, it's just the argument of V.
Okay.
Just the distance between the two sites that are where the electrons interacting. Okay, so the point is that everything has an Ri in it. So we're just going to factor that out. And then just the sum over the separation, the relative. And now you can do this sum. No, you can't. You can do it if you... This sum and difference of wave vectors dotted into Ri summed over I. So actually, it struck me last night, and it actually made me feel very nervous, that this sum, I think, maybe is not exactly like the one that we just did that had a k minus k prime in it. Because in that case, k minus k prime had to be 0. But in this case, we've got 4 wave vectors in the first Brillouin zone added together. And you can imagine that they might add up to a reciprocal lattice vector. If they add up to a reciprocal lattice vector, then every term in this sum is 1. Okay, so the proper way of writing this result is that this sum of q vectors has to be a reciprocal lattice vector, which could be, and in fact almost always is, 0. Okay, but there are these other possibilities for the sum of these 4 vectors that they could be a non-zero reciprocal lattice vector. I thought about that for a while, and I decided that to a first approximation, adding up to 0 is the most, is going to, well, it's always going to be a possibility, and it's the one that's going to be, I would say, the most important, and that there are some, it's a more complicated situation where these things can add up to a reciprocal lattice vector. But I'd like to leave you to think about that, not now, in fact. And just say that these guys add up to 0. Okay? If they add up to a reciprocal lattice vector, I think that this is a scattering process which is called an Umlauf scattering process. It's the kind of process that you couldn't have in free space, but you can have in a crystal. And And to tell you the truth, I haven't actually fully thought through the consequences of that, except that I think that it doesn't actually happen. When you are looking at electrons, mainly the ones that can scatter are the ones that are close to the Fermi energy. And so it's hard for them to scatter by reciprocal Lattice Factor, but not impossible. I'm sure there are cases where that's important. But why don't we just, for the moment, make our lives easy and say that this means that k minus k prime plus q minus q prime equals 0, and then you pick up a factor of n. Yeah, my turn.
Sorry, why are the only possibilities either reciprocal Lattice Factor or 0?
Oh, okay. Well, it's a little bit like this other sum that we had. You know, the sum over I, e to the I, k minus k prime dot ri. Okay. Now, clearly, in this case, when k equals k prime, then every term is 1, and so you get n. And the question you're asking is, if k is not equal to k prime, why does that give you 0? That's your question, right? Okay. So the answer to that is that when k is not equal to k prime, if you think in a one-dimensional case where k is just a scalar, you know, 2 pi times an integer over L. And remember that we're working with periodic boundary conditions. So in one dimension, it's like a ring, right? And then this ri then just tells you what number site you are around the ring. They're all evenly spaced by a lattice constant. And these guys here are an integer over the number of sites times 2 pi. So what happens in that case is that e to the I k dot r is like the sum of exponentials that are evenly spaced around the circle. So they add up exactly to 0. That's the way k space has been designed, or these Fourier transforms. So basically, the k's are any multiple of these k's. It takes you around. Say, for instance, say that k minus k prime is pi. That's one of the possibilities. K minus k prime could be 2 pi times an integer, which is half the number of sites over the number of sites. So say it's pi. And then ri is just an integer going from 0 to n minus 1. So basically, you're going plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus, adding to 0. And it's the same thing for any other of the allowed values of k. You're summing, you're going around the unit circle in the complex plane by steps that are k, but they add up to 0. Okay, and you can work it out for yourself, but that's the basic idea. So that's fine for these guys because these are both vectors in the Brillouin zone. Therefore, they can't be a reciprocal lattice vector apart. Brillouin zones only, that's the maximum width. It's a little different here because you got 4 of them. And so I think that they could be a reciprocal lattice vector. If these things add up to a reciprocal lattice vector, then again, every one of these terms is 1. And you get n. Okay? And if it's a reciprocal lattice vector plus something which is a vector in the Brillouin zone, and you're summing, and then you sum over I, you get 0 for exactly the same reasons. Because the reciprocal lattice vector just gives you a factor of e to the 2 pi I, which comes out, or 4 pi I, or 8 pi I. So that's why this is a more complicated case, because here I argued that it's the difference of two vectors in the Brillouin zone. And here I'm arguing that it's. Now maybe, you know, you can definitely have umklopf there. Okay, so where are we? Yes. I guess it's getting late. Oh, but actually, there's hardly anything left, okay? So we have this. So the way I've written it in my notes here is minus Q prime is equal to K minus K prime, and we'll call that big Q. And so Q prime we'll get rid of and write it as Q plus Q. And K prime we'll get rid of and write it as K minus Q. And so, and we're going to define V of Q is defined as sum over rho e to the I Q dot rho V of rho. That's this. And so the answer, this is a good place to stop, is 1 over 2n sum over q v of q. This is the Fourier transform of v. There. Sum over k and q alpha and beta c dagger k alpha c dagger q beta c q plus q beta c k minus q alpha. Okay? And so that's the form of the interaction in momentum space. Yes, Bruno.
Why is it that we have to just make the sum
of V of Ri minus Rj? Oh, no, the exchange interaction includes itself. Okay? We'll get to that, yeah. Yeah, this is just an interaction that is a spin-dependent interaction. But nevertheless, particles can't scatter into the same state with the same spin and so forth. So it will all come out in the wash. This is not a... So here what we have is not a spin-independent potential. Whenever you have an exchange interaction, it's sort of like an effective potential that's resulted from, you'll see. We'll get to that. Okay. Any other questions? Because we are sort of.
You can see the lecture?
What's that?
Can I ask?
No, it's just it's almost 11.
Can I ask non-related questions to this?
Yeah, please, go ahead.
Back to strong interacting with Hamiltonian.
Yep.
How do you include other orbitals? I didn't really get how you go about that.
Well, so in the kinetic energy, which I've erased, in the one particle term, you would be able to create and destroy electrons in several different orbitals, which would have several different average energies, E naught. It would then have an index, and the hopping intervals would be different. Okay, and you might end up with overlaps between different orbitals, which would make the T into a matrix, which you'd then have to diagonalize to get the eigenfunction. So it could get a lot more complicated. But then here, too, again, this V would carry extra indices saying which orbitals are the electrons in that are interacting. So this would, again, be more complicated. But it's not an uncommon situation at all. That's, in fact, what happened most of the time. Okay, I think we better let Lob in.